Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karmateksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Buddhist Pilgrimage, Join the Journey by Kathy Lamo Jackson. Why do people travel to the ends of the earth to experience spirituality? Where and why do Buddhists go on pilgrimage? In this Dharma Talk, Kathy Lamo and members of the Columbus KTC Sangha share some of their pilgrimage experiences. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karmateksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
So good morning, everyone. Just for recording's sake, this is Columbus Karmateksum Choling, KTC. And today is November 6th, 2022. I'm Kathy Lamo Jackson, and the talk today is going to be on pilgrimage. Primarily pilgrimage, I would say, in India, but also in your lives, how that affects you. And after this talk, we're going to have a special presentation for Kim Miracle, who's been our incredible director all these years during the build of this building and before. So just to let you know, that's going on immediately after this talk. So I might cut out a little early. So why don't we first read this on page 34. This is called the Tashi Prayer, which means auspiciousness, also called Verses of the Eight Noble Auspicious Ones. And I spoke on this maybe a month ago on a Sunday talk. And this is a prayer that is traditionally done when you begin anything new, in the morning when you wake up. Also, before you go to bed at night, you say this prayer for blessings. And it is a prayer that was actually spoken by the Buddha. So it's very ancient words. It was re-edited by Meepam Rinpoche, but it's a prayer where we're asking for blessings from the Buddhas, from Bodhisattvas, their partners or consorts, and protectors from very ancient times. And it has, the history of this is, we were told about this prayer probably in around 1990 by Kempo Karcha Rinpoche, who was the founder of the center. He lived in upstate New York in our monastery there. And he said, whenever people call me or leave a message that I'm having a problem with my job, with my health, with my family, with my life, he said, I always do this prayer because this is traditionally done for everyone, for all living beings, and of course ourselves also. So let's begin. And normally I put my hands in prayer for this, or Anjali, where you would hold it at your heart and have your, almost like a little gem is in between your hands. Don't worry how you sound. This is a great prayer to memorize. Okay, let's begin. Om Nam Si Nanda Dan Si Lan Jo Pe Da Si Cho Jo Si Na Su Pa Yi San Je Jo Dan Gen Dun Pa Pe So Kun La Cha Sa Da Cha Tra Si Sho Dun Me Gya Po Sa De Dun Jo Gom Jam Pe Gen Ba Ge Ra Pa Dam Ba Kun La Gom Po Gya Che Dra Pa Chen Lung Po Ta Pa Tsa Dra Pa Dan Ni Sem Chen Tan Che La Go Dra Pe Pa Yi Tsin Tse Pa Tsa Ra Dra Pa De Tan Tu Pe Dra Shi Pa Pa Wa De Wa Che Pa Ge La Cha Tsa La Yang Pa Shu Nu Pa De Do Je Tsin Chen Re Si Guang Gong Bo Chang Pa Pa Sa Yi Nim Bo Dre Pa Pa Prayer we will say with this sheet. The front side says refuge prayer, and we will say this three times, once in Tibetan and then two times in English. Sanje Chodan Soki Chonamla Jan Chubardu Dani Kyatsuji. Dagegen zog die Pässe nahm die Dolabenschir Sanje Dobarschok. English. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Assembly Most Excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Let's do it in Tibetan the third time. It's so, everyone's sounding so pretty. Sanje Chodan Soki Chonamla Jan Chubardu Dani Kyatsuji Nagi Gensok Kipe Sunamgi. I don't think I've seen this many people in here for a class. This is great. So today's topic is pilgrimage. And you might think it's a strange topic to bring up, but I think it's something we do. If you come here every Sunday, you're actually sort of going for pilgrimage here. But before we open it up and talk about pilgrimage in terms of Buddhist perspective, I just wondered if anyone has ever gone on pilgrimage. You can just raise your hand if you've gone to a monastery, a stupa, or you've gone to a Christian place of pilgrimage. So where did you go? Oh, very nice. So I don't know if you heard that. He said that he went to the stupa in Colorado, built by Chogyam Trungpa's group. I forget the name of it now. It's a beautiful structure. Anyone here ever gone to, what is the one? Any of you done the Camino de Santiago, the Christian pilgrimage? So how many of you have gone to KTD Monastery? So a lot of people. So that's basically a pilgrimage. And as I said, you're here. This is, in a sense, a pilgrimage. I would say some people would say going to Disney World would be a pilgrimage for their family, or Universal Studios, or maybe what's it called? Comic-Con? Because, you know, any of you done any of that? I mean, those are special destinations. So maybe first I should talk about what I'm talking about today for pilgrimage. It's usually considered a spiritual journey to a sacred place. A new term they now use is sacred geography. And it's where one is going seeking wisdom, blessings, transformation, often to a holy place, and often to a place where you've never been before. So there's some tension there about going somewhere that might be slightly difficult, especially if you're going like to travel to India on a very long flight and then deal with the roads, the pollution, the lack of the type of sanitation we're used to. But it's good. It's often good to have some hardships along the way. So for Buddhists, we primarily go to places where the Buddha had lived. That's one of the, some of the main pilgrimage sites. But I just thought for a moment we should also realize that we are not alone in this. Hinduism, which is a very, very ancient religion, has thousands of sites that are considered sacred, where a teacher lived in a cave or the confluence of different rivers that come together. And also, even the Ganges River is considered a deity, Mother Ganges. And so some main sites in India people go to is Varanasi, where they often go for purification and to die. That's on the Ganges. And many that follow the path of Krishna, Lord Krishna, will go to Vrindavan, where he lived and played out his leelas. The next is Judaism. I didn't know if any of you had been to any of the sites, the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, which I did not realize was a retaining wall for the first and second temple of Jerusalem. It's very, very ancient. Also, I work with a great deal of people at the hospital that are Muslim, and late at night we see them praying. We have certain areas in the hospital where they can go and do their prayers together, and they're always bowing. They have special indicators at the hospital, a special arrow pointing towards Mecca, so they do it in the correct direction. And most of them have gone on Hajj, they call it, going to Mecca. I mentioned Buddhism, and we'll visit that in a moment. And then Christianity, I don't know if any of you have ever been to Bethlehem or Jerusalem. No? So I hope after you hear today's talk, maybe you'll be inspired. I'm hoping before I die to go back to Bodh Gaya, India, because I lived there for 6 months. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But so let's just visit. Well, why would people want to go through the financial hardship and the physical hardships to go to these places? It's just amazing being transported back almost in time. You almost step back. I know some people here are travelers. So even going to our monastery is sort of stepping back in time, because the monastery is not like something we normally go to in our daily life unless you live there. And once you go there many times, you forget about how extraordinary this place is. And we go there, of course, for our spiritual development and for purification. And to always, we normally go there to receive teachings.
So, and also a lot of other people go for pilgrimage, not only to monasteries or to stupas, which are memorial mounds where ashes of holy beings have been placed there. I mean, we have a stupa here at our center, which is pretty amazing. But I think, and also, has anyone here been to Tibet? Not in this crowd. So Tibet has many, many holy places. Also, the Batala, where the His Holiness Dalai Lamas have all lived, Mount Kailash, and also Nepal. There's so many special caves. So I was talking about the sites. So often people go specifically to tiny little places where a teacher had died, and that's considered a very holy site. And when I lived, the last time I went to India, I had a few days off, so I researched the teacher I had always wanted to study with but had died before I was a Buddhist. And I was actually able to find his remains in a tiny stupa. So since I'm talking about stupas, the structure, have all of you seen the structure outside? Okay, so Lama Kathy wrote something very nice about it. So I'll just talk about it. So yeah, let me read these two things, and this might kind of get a few things where I want to go. So since the time of Buddha Shakyamuni, who lived in the 6th century before BCE, stupas was a word that meant mound, and to represent the presence of enlightened energy in the world. The stacked shapes, the geometric shapes, suggest a Buddha sitting in meditation, because it's some of it's round and some of it's square. And inside are relics, mantras, and lots of tiny little stupas that magnify its blessings. Ours here is full of all of those things, musical instruments. Does anyone else, I know a few people were here. Julaine, did you see what else was put in the stupa here? Yeah, we were busy doing other things when Lama Tashi was filling it. I hope we have more information on that later. But they're filled with things, and originally they were tiny little mounds. And Orville said, my husband studied a lot of East Asian art history, and he said at the time when the Buddha died, going back to India for a moment, because he lived and died in India. He was born in India, but later on with geography, it sounded like he was born in Nepal. It was right on the border. So there were four main places where he was born: Lumbini, where he awakened, Ambo Gaya, where he did the first teachings in Varanasi and Sarnath area, and then where he died in Kushinagar. And when he was cremated, his remains were divided into 8 groups. They were given to 8 different monks to take to different regions of India, and then to build a mound over it. Well, that was the 6th century BCE. Around the 3rd century BCE, those mounds had kind of really almost gotten lost. So along came an emperor called Ashoka. Anyone hear of him? How do you know about him? Right. So I think I can't hear really well because all of our wonderful masks for protection. But he lived. He was a famous conqueror. And this is a time where things are very tumultuous in India. So many different things were happening, different groups coming in. And eventually, at one battle, there were over 100,000 people that were displaced, 100,000 people that were killed by his troops. And he looked out on the field, and he was so overwhelmed with sadness of what he had done, he became a Buddhist. He converted to Buddhism. And in doing so, he decided he was a real organizer. So he went to those 8 places and he dug up the relics. He left some there, but then he dispersed it to 84,000 other sites. And he started to build very long-lasting structures instead of just a mound of earth. And he actually kind of was part of a team that discovered making sandstone bricks. And some of them are still standing today. So the most famous place for pilgrimage in India is where the Buddha was enlightened, called Bodh Gaya. And my husband and I were very fortunate to live there for a long time. I mean, a long time is 6 months there is a long time. You know, everything about it was rough but wonderful at the same time. And the activity for your whole day was you would eat, you wake up, you would eat. We didn't have really much water to shower because it was pretty rugged. But then we would, everything was about going to the stupa to practice. And it's ancient. It's so ancient that in India, there was no excavation for centuries. So everything just kept building up on itself. So to go into Bodh Gaya, into the actual Mahabodhi temple complex, you go down about 20 stairs. And there's a whole other world down there. And there's three different levels where people would do circumambulation around an edifice that today stands 150 feet tall. And it's very beautiful. It's not a stupa, it's just considered a temple. But inside of it is a very beautiful Buddha. He's about 4 feet tall. The original one was, I guess, used by somebody else and removed. A lot of things in India are moved around. And all over the grounds are tiny little stupas, kind of like the one we have here, a little bit bigger, but kind of funny looking, because what happened is this was all lost. So jumping back for a moment, the third century BCE, when Ashoka built monasteries, built these stupas, well, they over time, there were a lot of conquering groups of people that came through, and they destroyed the entire area. They destroyed most of the stupas. But along comes the British, right? The British archaeological teams came in, and the Germans in the late 1800s, and they had permission because they were ruling the land at that time, and they started to dig up all these sites. So if it hadn't been for them, we would have never known about these incredible sites. And they unearthed a great deal. But if they had a lot of things and they couldn't figure out what to do with them, they kind of made their own little stupas. So in Bodh Gaya, you have this big spire that is the third rendition of the building. But all around it are these funny little mounds of bricks and other things. And if you walk through the villages nearby, you'll suddenly see a piece of maybe 1,000-year-old sandstone. It's rather fascinating in front of our little hut. But what's so amazing about this site is it's really gone through a huge revival. I would say going back hundreds and hundreds of years ago, Tibetans would actually do anything they could to get over there. All the Buddhists from around the world at that in the ancient times would go there. So a lot of people we've heard about, Nagarjuna, Atisha, many of them actually helped build certain parts of that compound that are still standing today. I've seen many pictures of the 16th Karmapa and a lot of pictures of the teachers when they escaped from Tibet go there. And it was really exciting to see them because there's certain very distinctive markers when you look at that complex. So it has great history to it. And when you're there, and there's a lot of places, it's like a gigantic garden on many levels. And when you're there, you can rent a prostration board. I did not know this. So of course I had one built and it was so rough. Prostration board is where people standing up, go down and do a full body prostration, come back up while they're doing a visualization and saying prayers. And I couldn't use it. So I just left it there. And within a week, all the Tibetans had put butter on their hands and there was a groove in it during prostrations. So my board was very lovely. They took care of my board. So you can do your prostrations there. It's a great place just to sit and do practice, because you hear all the parakeets and the birds flying around. And the one part I haven't mentioned is the Bodhi tree where the Buddha sat. he sat under this very specific fig tree or people tree, P-I-P-A-L, and that's where he was enlightened. And the original tree was destroyed when the rest of the complex was destroyed, but cuttings of it had been taken to Sri Lanka, and they replanted it. And this tree is massive. It covers blocks, and it's very well cared for. And if you're lucky, a leaf will fall down while you're there, and you can keep it. But it's a very, very holy site to go to. And what do you do there? You do the same thing you would do here, or the same thing you would do if you were at a monastery. You would make offerings. And there's always people there to buy tiny little candles, incense, prayers. You would do circumambulation. It's just a great place. And so I've been reading some of the observations that Lama Kathy made about when Rinpoche wanted to have our building restored. And he said, this is like being in a stupa. We have the Buddhas behind us. We have all these Buddhas and statues in back of us are all consecrated. So I don't know if you know what that means. So have any of you seen the big boxes down in the basement? So those are gigantic. Thanks to so many people sitting in the room right now that took care of that. We are so fortunate that we have here all these statues in back of us. Many of us have these statues at our homes that have actually been consecrated, meaning they're hollow inside. They are filled with certain mantras, usually little bits of relics. And these particularly would all have relics in them. And then special prayers are said to them, over them, so that the blessings of that statue flows out to help everyone else and inspires us. So in a sense, even though I got to live somewhere where possibly the dust of the Buddha was still in the air, even here, that's still the same. We're so fortunate to have all of these different things that are sitting here. This is very rare. If you go to our monastery, it's bigger and grander, but we still have this. And what's so amazing, I was looking at the shrine this morning. I forgot most of these statues were the ones that were in our fire that survived. Maybe they are not as shiny, but they survived that amazing fire that destroyed everything except the statues. So they're very, very special. And also at our center, we have this beautiful stupa outside where when you come in, it would be really nice if, sometimes you can't see it, it's blocked a little bit by the trees, but just go a little bit past them and you'll see this concrete form. And Lama Tashi last November with many monks from KTD Monastery, and lamas from Karmi Ling, monastics from Karmi Ling, consecrated it. And it was pretty intense, all the offerings. Chuck knows there was fire pujas going nonstop. And it was a very active time because Lama Tashi, who consecrated that, and who will be consecrating our statuary that will be brought up here eventually, he's very thorough. So we're very fortunate to have him. So even though maybe you don't want to spend 18 hours on a flight to India and go to Bodh Gaya, India or somewhere, you can always come here. And I think that's very important for people to realize. I just wanted to see. I also wanted to talk about, this building, this is very traditional Tibetan to build on top of another building. So this building, this site, is where we have had so many special teachers come. His Eminence Situ Rinpoche, Jama Rinpoche, Gyaltsa Rinpoche, Trungpa Rinpoche, Minja Rinpoche, of course, Gimbal Karcha Rinpoche, and many, many lamas have all been on this site, consecrating it further. So going back to, if you're in a place like Bodh Gaya, you might also be there for the big prayer festival called a Munlam that is right down the street. It used to be on that site, but but it was too crowded with 5,000 people. So, but during certain parts of the Munlam, they actually go back to Bodhgaya itself, to the Mahabodhi Temple, and make offerings there. So have any of you ever thought to travel to Asia? To go? I hope I'm not playing it down. I wish I had a slideshow, but I haven't figured out how to do it with this newer system that we're doing, but I'm working on it. I'll tell you one story. One morning, I used to get up very early to go to there and I was just beginning prostrations. And I would get my little board and start doing prostrations. And somebody came over to me and poked my arm very hard. Tibetans, to get your attention, often will just poke your arm. And so I looked up and there was this really very, very demure looking old lady. And she was dressed as a nun. And she kind of grabbed my clothes, so I stood up. And I noticed she had a bucket with her, so she handed me the bucket, and then she handed me another one. And then I didn't realize there was a tap nearby. We filled them with water, and I followed her around. And so you do circumambulation when you're at the stupa. So we went in the correct pattern. And suddenly we're standing in front of the Bodhi tree, which is there's a gate all around it. And where the Buddha sat is, and this was built by Ashoka, he built something out of sandstone that is, it looks like double dorjes, but it's all out of stone. And that's what's on the earth right there, because that was where the Buddha had sat to become enlightened. And suddenly this little old nun pulls out this long key, puts it in the lock, and suddenly this door opens up and she helps me go in to water the Bodhi tree with her. I'm like bawling, right? Just bawling. I'm realizing, first I thought, what does this lady want? Here she is. And I realized she did this to people every day. She had somebody else have the merit to do that. It was just so astounding. And another time, I was doing practice. I really learned to relax doing practice there because everybody is practicing. And people will come over, like when you do prostrations, you have to stand up for a few minutes to get your breath. And someone will come over and just start talking to me. I'm like, why are they talking to me? This is my practice time. But people are much more relaxed doing practice there because they're there for months usually doing practice. And people would hand me oranges and want to know where I'm from. And one day, this man came wearing very different clothes. That's the coolest thing about Bodhgaya. You will see people from every corner of Asia there. There were people I would walk up to and ask, and people couldn't speak any language that anyone else knew. They were so from remote corners of India and other places. And often I would get there at 6 a.m. when they opened the main gates. And some days I would realize there was already like 50 Tibetans already in there, really old ones, all doing prostrations. And I found out that in the middle of the nights they would climb over the fences to make, because they had basically escaped from Tibet to go there. They didn't, you know, go down to the street, go over to New York City and get a visa to go to India. They just went to Bodhgaya. And also, they usually never washed their clothes because they felt it was so sacred to be in Bodhgaya. Because they would take those clothes when they would go home and give them to other people as relics of having been around the dust of the Buddha. But this one day, it was the afternoon, I remember, and this unusual looking man came up to me and started talking to a monk who could understand him. And he was from Bhutan. And I used to have long hair, long blonde hair. And he said they never saw a wrathful one that had white face, because usually our wrathful deities have yellow hair. And he thought it would be really good for the village if somebody would pray for them. So it gave me like 10 rupees. I'm like, no, no. And the monk said, you have to take it. So of course I used it somewhere else. I lit candles for him. But he told me to do 108 prostrations for his village. It was the sweetest thing. So there's an amazing camaraderie when you go on pilgrimage. It's not just about you. You start learning about all these other people that are searching. They're searching for inspiration, and it's just astounding. So there's so many people in this room I know have been to our monastery and have been to Carmei Ling. Would any of you like to talk about it as an experience of pilgrimage? This is a really quiet crowd today. No. Eric?
Yeah.
I mean, Eric, is it, would you mind going up to the mic?
No.
I mean, Eric has taken me so many times to the monastery. So I'm talking about pilgrimage today. He's a famous storyteller.
One of my favorite parts of pilgrimage is making a pilgrimage to the pilgrimage, particularly with this one, because she has so many good stories and knows so much stuff. I'll say two things. One that piggybacks on something you just said. During the Karmapa's first visit to America, we went up to Carmei Ling after we were at KTD. It was kind of a thing, not everybody went. And it was raining and inclement and muddy. And they set this tent where Karmapa and all of us would be in up on the hill, and the hill was solid mud. And they parked all these cars on the hill. And people kept getting stuck. It was like sometimes you go on pilgrimage and when you want to leave, you can't. That's considered good fortune. Anyway, I think the first time I went to KTD even, I ended up with leaving my car in the parking lot. I was there for about a week. And no, it wasn't the first time, but I'd been chasing around. Dalai Lama was giving a series of talks, and I saw him in Buffalo. Then I went to see my son in college in Rensselaer. And then I drove down to KTD because Dalai Lama was going to be there. Left my car sitting there. I was in heaven. The great thing about pilgrimage is, no matter what the situation is, the difficulties of getting onto it, getting over resistance to it, when you get there, it's amazing. So anyway, that trip, I had two flat tires and a dead battery, you know, like many, many miles from home. What's that?
Great pilgrimage.
I know, they wanted to keep me. What can I say? But when we went to see Karmapa, I was helping push cars out of the mud. You know, you do all this practice, you're with all these holy beings, you're kind of in bliss. What is it Jack Kornfeld says? After enlightenment, the laundry or something like that? Well, this is like after enlightenment, pushing cars out of the mud. And I had these overalls on, and they got covered head to toe with the sacred mud of the hillside at Carmei Ling. And I never washed them. I didn't have enough wisdom to give them away, however. So, but I think what you're saying about pilgrimage is really true. There's always resistance. Once you've decided to go, things come up. All kinds of things, health things, mechanical things, cars breaking down, all kinds of stuff come up. It's good, I think, to just deal with it and move on and still go. Because somehow the blessing is enormous, and these little obstacles just come up to just check, you know, test your resolve, I think. And it's always worth it. And there's also always so many beings that you see and that you don't see. You know, Chen Rezi's still around, Tara's still around, Buddha's still around. We may not see them, but they're here, they're pulling for us. They don't want to see anything except your enlightenment. They're rooting for you every day. So obstacles come up and it's an invitation to connect in some kind of a deep way to them, to overcome the obstacle so that you can have your own experience and have more confidence to do that for others as well. So anyway, that's what I feel like about pilgrimage. It's such an extraordinary way to build your own experience and confidence in a very positive direction. Thank you.
One thing I really should mention, I recently saw a lovely talk by Lama Yeshe Gyamso, who was a wonderful translator in our lineage, and also translated for Bardo Tulku Rinpoche's group. He said, if you hear of something someone has had the opportunity to do, do not be jealous for them. Realize it must be their karma, and you rejoice in when you see other people having opportunities. I used to be so jealous when I would hear people got to go to the monastery and I had to work, and then one day I decided to play a game with myself and to rejoice in that, to be happy for them. I do make the aspiration, may I also be able to have that opportunity someday. So for any of you that are thinking, oh, well, you know, that was then, and maybe these opportunities aren't there, they are all the time. And Trungpa Rinpoche wrote a wonderful book about the history of India, and he said that so many villagers in tiny little remote places all over the Himalayan region, they have nothing compared to us, but they always have enough money to get to Bodh Gaya or to go on pilgrimage somewhere because they scrimp and save, and they do extra jobs just so they can do that. And he said that, and they've all said, we should rejoice in those that have gone and pray that those who wish to go, may they have that wonderful opportunity. But he addressed several times in his book about the hardships that you will face. Because when you're on a journey, like any journey, and you're kind of out of your comfort zone, you come to grips with your limitations, then you realize, well, do you really have those limitations? It's just things that we're used to here. And I remember the last time I was in India, one time I got to actually go with Kempo Karcha Rinpoche, which was a very rare event. He, as I mentioned earlier, for some of you who don't know who he is, he died in 2019 in his late 90s. He was an amazing teacher. And he let me and my husband go with him and a few other people to Bodh Gaya because His Holiness Gyalpo Karmapa was going to do the first Munlam there. It was the roughest trip of my friggin' life. I had already lived in India. I was older. There was no railing in most places. I've had a stroke. I could hardly walk through certain areas because you had to walk through really narrow places where all these monks are sitting. And I was, after day one, all the monks would put their hands up. So I got to hold on to people as I walked down. It was amazing. I would go to other areas where the guards would want to almost throw you down the stairs because I moved a little slower. And then after day one, a guard realized I was a little disabled that he walked me every day. It was the sweetest thing. But after we left Bodh Gaya, we had to go somewhere else. And this one night, the room where we stayed for us was deplorable. It was all moldy and funky. I have asthma. I was just weeping. I was miserable. And Kempo Karcha Rinpoche came to our room and apologized. And I felt terrible because his room, I'm sure it was worse. But I really learned then to suck it up. Just suck it up and realize it's all blessings. And when my husband and I did live in India years ago, I was sick almost every other week with dysentery, worms, you name it, I had it. I got the weirdest fevers of my life in India. It's just my karma, I guess. And everyone's mantra was, oh, the Buddha. So the Buddha has actually said in many places in the sutras, is quoted to say, it's really wonderful if you can go on pilgrimage. So I realized that, oh, and this other quote is, it's wonderful if you die in a pilgrimage site. So people always say to me, don't worry if you die here, this is a great blessing. I never felt threatened or anything. I mean, I felt very safe there, even in terms of my health. It was just, I wasn't, you know, I was outside of my comfort level. And then after a while, I completely enjoyed every moment of it. But it took a while, because I had to get comfortable with the uncomfortable. But going back to modern day today, I just hope that all of you realize where you are right here is very rare. It's considered just to be a Buddhist or to go to a Buddhist site is as rare as a star in a daylight sky. To be here, to have this incredible building that our wonderful board, and I believe Kim is here. Is she sitting here? I thought I saw her. There you are. Hi, Kim. I swear you came in that way originally, so I didn't see you. Thank you, Kim, for everything. I'll never stop thanking you. And, of course, Bill. And Chuck and Eric and all the people that were on the board all these years. And all the people that donated money over the years. I was just so surprised being at certain events. I mentioned this before. One time, Lama Tom asked a few of us if we wanted to go to the monastery, and I said, no, I don't have enough money. He said, no, it'll all work out, and it all did. We couldn't stay there, and it was a special ceremony where Kempo Karcham Rinpoche was being blessed by the Karmapa. I had no idea the Karmapa was there, and I think what took my breath away was there wasn't... Maybe there were five people in a room of 500 I knew. Normally, most of us know a lot of people. They were all from Taiwan, some of them from China, some Japan, and other areas throughout Asia. And then there was a Tibetan group, and they were all there to celebrate Kempo Karcham Rinpoche being blessed by the Karmapa. This is when, if you've ever seen pictures, he actually stood on his throne and read prayers. I've never seen that before. And then he put the red sindaroo powder on Rinpoche's forehead. He fed him yogurt. He blessed him. I mean, that's, talk about a place full of blessings. It was unbelievable. But the part of the story that blew me away was outside in the main kind of entryway, it was a table, and it said Columbus KTC. And I'm thinking, what is this? And it had all of Rinpoche's practice material, his Balan Dorje, his Damaru, and they were selling it for outrageous money for Columbus KTC. And I didn't even know that. And Lama Lodra, one of the nuns that a lot of us know, she came over to me and she said, this is for the center. And I said, I don't even know these people. And she said, I know. She said, we have a big organization. So today we should rejoice in all those that helped donate their money and their kindness and their energy and their effort for this building. So it's 12:20. I doubt if there's any questions about today, but I hope that you have the opportunity someday to go. This is a wonderful, wonderful place for pilgrimage. Even your home when you practice is a type of pilgrimage. But someday I hope you get to go where the dust of the Buddha is still in the air and go there and also have some adventures. And if I do go, I'll let people know. I would love just to have a group to go. We should find a Lama, a Tibetan or Bhutanese. Take us there. They have all the connections. Okay, so let's take a moment. And we'll read the dedication prayer at the flip side. Um, Sonam di tamje sepani, tone nepe dranam pamjene, kega nachi bala drupai, sipe sole drawar, drawar sho, jampa pawo jita kempada, kuntu sampo deyan de shinde, deda kungi jesu dalochin, ewa di da tamche ratungo. In English? By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. Let's just have a moment of silence. Thank you, everyone. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.